Okay, hi there. Very good. Do I need to turn the volume up? I guess so, since nobody's responding. Okay, we'll do that. How's that? Or do I just need to speak more forcefully and then you'll be able to hear me? I know that you're all talking about the course material. Okay. I'm going to give you the last hour and 10 minutes of energy that I have today. And then I'm going to skip a birthday party and go home and go to bed. How about that? Okay. How many of you are sick? Bummer. And all the people who aren't here are also sick. So anyway, mine will be short, very short. My sickness, that is. It'll be over by tomorrow. Okay? Somebody brought it back from Colorado. All right. Exam analyses down here. If you forgot to bring your exam, bring it to the office tomorrow so we can put them together. Questions? I shouldn't stand so close to you. Okay. Review sessions next week. We have one scheduled for after class on Wednesday, a week from today, and that will be in Fleming 101. The exam is on Monday, December 11th. So the question is, do you want review sessions? If so, when would you like them? So, would you like one Thursday late afternoon? Raise your hand if this is something you would like, and then we'll try to sort out which one. So I'm going to ask about several times. So raise your hand as often as you want, and then we won't offer that many, but we'll try to hit the ones that are most likely to be used. Okay, Thursday the 7th, late afternoon, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. Friday, the 8th, early afternoon. That's the first exam day. Saturday, the 9th, in the morning, early afternoon. Sunday, the 10th, 7 a.m. Early afternoon, late afternoon, evening. Monday morning, right before the exam. No. Okay. Okay, we'll come back with a couple of specific times, but it looks like Sunday again. Then Sunday doing a review session and my wife won't be happy, and then the following week, and I'll spend the whole weekend grading exams and getting grades ready, and it helps. I just give her my paycheck and then she's okay. Yeah. How do you get final exams back? You can get your essays back anytime after we finish. We will finish on Monday, the 18th, at noon. So anytime after that, you can stop by the office and pick them up. We will post the distribution outside C-150 as soon as we can. And the grades get posted by the registrar almost instantaneously. We will turn them in Monday. They'll probably be up on Tuesday for you to access. So. Anything else? A conflict with exam schedules cannot happen unless you're taking classes at the same time, according to the registrar. Unless someone has moved an exam to a time that is more convenient or something, which they are not permitted to do. So you'll be here, and we'll complain about whoever... Did somebody move an exam? Different question. They're not all scheduled at the same time. Different question. If you have three final exams on the same day, you may request that one of them be moved. You all know that. No, it hasn't happened to you before. You do not have to take three finals on the same day. So you may approach any of your faculty and request a change on the grounds that you have three in one day and one of them has to change.
I think you've said this before. What time do you get done, or what time average are you done with this exam?
This exam, let's see, I have to recalculate because we're starting with these odd times. So this one's 11:45 instead of 12. Most of you will be done by 2. But don't make your plane reservation for 2:15. Okay. Can you start the exam late? Sure. I just was having a memory flash of one of my final exams in college in January when they were three-hour essay exams. And the deal when I was in college was that there were no makeup exams. You took it, and you took it when it was scheduled. And if you missed the exam for any reason, like being ill, you were permitted to take the exam the next time the course was offered. So this was a significant drag with courses that were offered every other year, particularly if you were a senior. Right? So anyway, exam started at 9, was due to be over at noon, and about 10:15, there was a clatter at the door. The door swung open, and one of our classmates came in, pajamas, bathrobe, and overshoes, and sat down to take the exam. He had overslept, but he was there. But you were only permitted to work until 12 in that case. So he didn't finish, but at least he was there. I will never forget that. Slam. Down his bathrobe and boots. All right. Anything else? Recognize this guy? Isn't he cute? That's Eric Erickson. And today I'm going to talk about Eric Erickson. The text uses, sort of, or says it will use Erickson's psychosocial theory to organize some of the material. Since Erickson's is the only lifespan theory that we have, that has stages that apply to each of the stages and describes each of them as unique stage. And the text actually does a fair job of describing each of the stages and what the important issues are. It's a bare bones presentation, and they don't connect it very well to much of anything else, but for what it's worth, it's there. What I want to do is talk more generally and more specifically about Erickson's explanation of the process of development and tell you what he was really trying to do, which the text does not present in any detail. So this is my version of what Erik Erickson was trying to do. In the interest of full disclosure of bias, he is my favorite psychosocial theorist. He has, from my perspective, the most useful theory about how people develop within their social context, and it is a theory that is infinitely useful and helps one understand what is going on at different stages of development and provides some provocative suggestions about how to understand what people are trying to do as we go through life. Erickson was born in 1902 in Germany. His parents, however, were Danish, and he considered himself Danish. But his father left the family early, and his mother married their pediatrician, whose name was Homburger, and he was German. So Erik Erickson began life a bit later as Erik Homburger, and actually published his first publications in German under that name. Later, after he left Germany because the Nazis were being nasty, and he was Jewish, both his parents and Homburger, his stepfather, were Jewish, and he decided to leave, went to the United States, came to the United States after the rise of the Nazi regime, and along the way changed his name. So for a little while, he published as Erik Homburger Erickson. There are no C's in his name, by the way. It's all K's. Erik and Erickson, they're Danish versions of the name, so there's no C. And then later decided to be Erik H. Erickson and then dropped the H. The Erickson was not his biological father's name. It was a name he chose because he wanted to emphasize two things. One, his Danishness. And two, he wanted to take advantage of Danish and Scandinavian naming systems in general to indicate that he was, in fact, his own son, because he had created his personality in large part on the basis of his own actions, and he wanted to indicate that his identity was more his own responsibility than anyone else's. So he chose to be Erik Erickson. He died at 92. I won't go into all the details. It's a very interesting life. I will just point out that his wife, Joan Erickson, was also a writer, wrote a very fine biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, which is still considered a definitive biography. She also was a painter and weaver, and her weavings are exhibited in a number of New England museums. Erik became famous, and I'll backtrack a little bit and give you some of his history that led up to his theory. But the important thing that I wanted to include here is that late in life, he was very clear about apologizing to his wife and to the world for not acknowledging the contributions that she made to his theory, to his understanding of human development, and to all of his work and his career. And he said it was a mistake for him to allow the world to believe that it was his theory when, in fact, it was their theory. He had published early on with her some of his early foundational writings were joint writings with her, and some of his later writings were with her and with their son, who is an anthropologist, his son Kai. So they have publications that are family publications, the family that writes together, fights together, or something like that. Anyway, Erickson graduated from the gymnasium, the secondary school, in Frankfurt, Germany, where he grew up, and wanted to make his way in the world, as many did after the First World War, as an artist. And he was an artist. So he traveled and tried to put life together as an artist and went to Italy and France and Spain and all those places, and ended up needing a job while he was in Vienna. And he got a job. His art wasn't selling very well on the sidewalk, which is why he needed a job. And he got a job as a gardener. And he got a job as a gardener at an American school for young children that was run by... It's odd that somebody calls it an American school, because Dorothy Burlingham, who was the principal person in it, was English. And Peter Bloss, who was the other person, had gone to high school with Erickson, which is in fact how he found out about them needing a gardener. And Bloss and Burlingham were running this school for kids under the direction of Sigmund Freud's daughter, Anna. Anna had wanted to start a school to apply her father's theories and to study children, and she recruited Burlingham from England and Bloss from Vienna. Bloss was at the time studying psychoanalysis, and Burlingham was an educator. So they started the school. And of course they discovered that that Eric was not only not very good at trimming hedges, but that he was actually wonderful with children. And he befriended the children and he started doing things with them. So they brought him in to the school staff with his high school education and his artistic talents. Just as a parenthetical comment, if any of you are really interested in trying to understand what psychoanalytic theory is about as it applies to development, Anna Freud's book called Psychoanalysis for Parents and Teachers is the best place to start on that, as she tries to explain her father's theory and then some of her own additions to it for parents and teachers in a practical way. What does this theory of psychoanalysis mean if you're raising or teaching children? What are they doing that represents what Freud was talking about? So, of course, Erik Erikson got interested in psychoanalysis and decided he wanted to become an analyst, and began a training analysis with Anna Freud and later with August Eichhorn, and became an analyst. So he was a graduate, if you will, of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Institute, and started off, he says, as a child analyst, which doesn't mean he was being an analyst when he was a child, it means he was analyzing children. On the way to being a psychoanalyst, though, he got some additional training which was very important in the development of his theory. There was an educator of young children who was becoming quite famous, had become quite famous by the late teens and 20s in the last century, in Rome, by the name of Maria Montessori. And Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham were interested in what Montessori's approach to education might imply for their school and how it might relate to Sigmund Freud's work. So they picked a likely candidate and sent Eric Erickson to Rome to study with Maria Montessori. And he became a Montessori teacher. At that time, you could do that in about 9 months. And he did that. And he was very proud of the fact that while he was a lecturer, a senior faculty member teaching at Harvard with an appointment in... So you just mention the name. And he was very proud of the fact that he had an appointment at Harvard Medical School in psychiatry, but had neither a college degree nor a medical degree. He was a psychoanalyst and a Montessori teacher, but those were the only formal trainings that he had had. But he was very, very proud of that. Thought it was a real nice indication of Harvard's commitment to diversity that they would hire and pay well a guy who had graduated from high school and was a Montessori teacher. So what did that mean? Well, let me put the Montessori piece in. This is crucial. It's crucial for understanding what Erickson was about. Maria Montessori had many ideas about children, but the core thread through her work is that children's minds are formed by their actions in the world and are a reflection of the organization of the world that they experience. So if you grow up in a chaotic world where things are not orderly, where you don't have a chance to learn some of the fundamental schemes that allow us to organize information and process it. She was a good Piagetian. Actually, Piaget stole all of her ideas and incorporated them into his own work. Montessori was a believer that if you are in a chaotic environment, you will develop a mind that is fairly disorderly. On the other hand, if your world is organized and has routines in it, you will construct mental processes that are orderly and in which routines and repeated patterns are important. And those routines and repeated patterns and complex schemas are the basis for all of your thinking. Montessori had worked with kids who came from the slums and who had problems in school, many of whom couldn't make it in school, and one of her early observations was that they had never had the opportunity to build the fundamental schemas. So she created a remedial program for those kids in which they had a very structured set of materials that they could play with and repeat the actions over and over again to create the understanding, the schemas in their minds that would allow them to go on to read and to learn math and to think logically. So she was saying these kids that she was dealing with had been in chaotic environments. They had missed these basic fundamental building blocks, which are the patterns of how things go together. So her remedial program was what she was teaching and spread around the world. It's important that it was a remedial program. It's very ironic that we have in the United States very expensive Montessori schools, mostly for rich kids. But it's a curriculum that was originally created for Head Start. It's also ironic that we created Head Start 30 years ago and it took them about 20 years to discover that Montessori had a curriculum that would work for the kids they were trying to deal with who were growing up in chaotic environments. The world is a funny place. What Erickson took away from Montessori's work was that children are developing within the context of the environment that they are in, and their understanding of the world will reflect the expectations, demands, and opportunities of that specific environment, because that's what they are learning about. That's what they are constructing their view of reality from. And he applied that not to their cognitive skills, but to their personalities, to their emotions, to their relationships, to their psychological development, and to their self-concept. Okay, so hold that idea in mind. Now, what did he take from Freud? He took all of Freud, basically, agreed with almost all of it, accepted it, and then extended it. And this is a simple way of understanding what he was trying to do. Freud had this notion that we develop biologically. You know, we are organisms. That's the first unit. Remember that one? And as we're developing biologically, we are driven by what he called the drives. We translate it incorrectly as instinct, but it's the id. We're driven by our impulses and whatever our particular desires are, and those are rooted in our biology. And as we develop, we go through stages of expressing our desires, and there is a sexual component to that for all of us that has to be dealt with. And our parents deal with that, and society deals with that, partly by repressing it, partly by channeling it. And what Freud had said was that if you develop neurotic symptoms, it may have something to do with the way you are trying to manage your impulses. So we've got sex on his mind, and we have people developing within a context that they're developing a psyche, a personality, an ego. And his theory was about how the sexual urges influence our personal development, our psychological development. And combining those two, we use the term for Freud that his is a psychosexual theory. In other words, he's trying to help us understand how our sexuality, very broadly defined and represented, how that sexuality influences our psychological functioning. A very important work. Erickson took that. He said, okay, what I'm interested in is I want to put that psyche, that psychological development, into its social context. We grow up in relationships. Remember Sullivan a couple of days ago? He said the same thing. We grow up in relationships, and our parental relationships, our family relationships, our peer relationships, our communities are an ever-changing set of social relationships that influence our psychological development. Our psychological development is really the manifestation of how we deal with the biological and the social. So his comes out as a psychosocial theory. So different. Freud talked a lot about parents and about society. He didn't ignore it. He wrote many books about this part that Erickson was trying to describe. But Erickson worked on it in a different way. So the easiest way to describe what Erickson is trying to do is that he's saying, okay, we develop all through life. And we develop a psyche, a self, self-concept, a way of being in the world, a personality, and that's the process that he focused on. And he said that process is the result of taking our internal changes, the way things happen, the biological part, and all of the stages that we go through, learning to walk, learning to be toilet trained, going through puberty, mating, getting old, going through menopause, all of those things. All of those we experience. And they happen in a relatively predictable and normal sequence across the lifespan, the whole lifespan. And we're trying to make sense out of those changes, and we're trying to respond to them. We're trying to incorporate the changing body into our self. So my self now reflects the fact that I'm 64 years old and I can't do some of the things that I used to do. When I was a teenager, myself and my struggles with myself were reflecting the fact that I'd gone through puberty and had to make sense out of that and its potentials. So we have demands and potentials that are created by the biological changes that we go through. But we do that at the same time in a context of social relationships, external to us. The external demands and expectations that come to us from other people that are important to us. The challenges, the potentials. And those change as we go from birth through having siblings, to going to school, to becoming adolescents, to getting married, to becoming parents, to whatever. Okay? So you have a lifespan perspective on the biology. You have a lifespan perspective on social relationships. And what the person is doing is trying to integrate both of those, respond to them, and create a self that makes sense and meets the demands of the body and meets the demands of the people that we're in. So in a sense, what he's saying is we are caught between our bodies and our relationships. And out of our experiences of ourselves and our bodies and our relationships and the expectations and the responses of other people, we create or attempt to create a stable but ever-changing personality. So that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to put those two together. Now, one of the reasons that he asserted that was that he recognized that this part, the biological part, has evolved over many, many millions of years. Human communities have evolved at the same time. We call it co-evolution. And we argue about chicken and egg, and he says there's no reason to think about chicken and egg because they go together. You can't have a chicken without an egg, without a chicken without an egg. You've got a biology and you have relationships. And all of our social relationships reflect the expectable biological changes. They reflect what is going to happen to our bodies. Every society has expectations for infants. Every society has a way of feeding infants. Every family has a way of feeding infants. We all feed infants. Every family, every society has expectations that children will learn to tie their own shoes. Well, if you're a society with shoes and not Velcro. If you're a society that has clothing, you have expectations for each child about how that child will learn to dress him or herself. We all expect children to become toilet trained. If they don't, we get upset. And we have different techniques for doing that. What Erickson pulled from anthropology, which he also studied and practiced, he did anthropology in the American West, both the Southwest and the Northwest, and in India, looking at how specific communities deal with the demands of the body. How do we deal with puberty? Some people have puberty rites. Some of you had the opportunity to go through puberty, and how many of you got slapped by your mother when you first menstruated? Very common in some cultures, and particularly in the southern European Mediterranean region in traditional families. Menstruate, you tell mom you menstruated, and she gives you a hearty slap across the face, which is a reminder that you are now a woman, pain will be part of your life, and you're still the daughter, even though you're a woman, so don't get out of place. Every society has rituals and customs and expectations that go along with each of the biological transitions. We all deal with pregnancy. We all deal with childbirth. We all deal with the parenting of children. We all deal with old age. We all deal with death. The biological is reflected in every culture. What's fun about anthropology is that it studies the variety of ways that social systems deal with the biological changes and expectations. We do courtship differently. We do mating differently. We do child rearing differently. And that's what anthropology is about, from a simple-minded perspective. So what Erickson did then was say, okay, here's what I'm trying to describe, how an individual is dealing with both the internal and external demands, and what kinds of problems we run into as we do that. As a psychoanalyst, of course, he was dealing with people with problems, people who weren't happy, people who couldn't function, people who had bizarre dreams, people who flunked out of college because they couldn't study, people who couldn't figure out what to major in. Remember, he was working at Harvard part of his life. And what he applied, how he applied his theory and developed it, was through looking at people in different stages of life and what kinds of problems they had and how they expressed those problems and eventually how those problems were based on the biological and or social expectations and changes they were going through and represented problems in their attempt to come to terms with or adjust themselves to the combination of changes. And as he did that, then he came up with his famous 8 stages. Based on the notion, this is from biology, that everything that grows has a ground plan built into the genes. So it's called an epigenetic principle. Your genes create an expectable pattern for you. And he suggested that while that's true of our bodies, it's also true of our psyches, because our personalities, our psychology, has co-evolved with our biology and with our social situations. So, as we develop each part of our psyche is going to come to the front, come to the top at a particular time. And that describes a stage. And these are in the text. You don't have to memorize them. Took me a few years to be able to get them right. The years don't matter, and those are not his, actually. Those are years put on by whoever did this slide. But, and I would turn it upside down, because that's what Erickson did. We start with the issue of trust in infancy. You can read upside down, right? Of course you can. And the first year and a half or so, developing a sense that the world is an orderly place is the primary psychosocial task. What am I dealing with in my mind as I experience infancy and am parented? The issue comes down, he said, to trust. And we are parented in ways that focus on teaching us to trust, or teaching us how much to trust. There really are words on that. And I don't expect you to read them. But the stages include issues of trust, issues of autonomy, being able to do things for yourself, initiative, being able to make decisions and carry them out, industry, the school years, learning to compete with other people, learning where you fit with your peers particularly, and learning whether or not you're inferior to them in some ways. Adolescence is for the creation or construction of an identity. As you go through puberty and you become formal operational and can think about all the possibilities, how do you make sense to create an identity that hangs together, that you can take on into college and fit your personality, which you're becoming able to understand in adolescence, fit your personality with a potential career, with an interest, with being a nurse, being an early childhood educator. Those need to hang together. You need to be the kind of person who can do that and get satisfaction from whatever that job is. And be consistent. Isomorphic, remember that one? Being consistent in your thinking and in your relationships of different kinds so that you feel like you hang together. Your psyche hangs together. You're not fragmented. Or diffuse was a word that he used. Scattered in who you are. You don't hang together. You're all scattered. Intimacy, as you put your identity together with somebody else's identity to create a partner relationship. Generativity, as you get into adulthood and want to have children or leave something behind or create something that will live beyond you, that will demonstrate that you were here and that you had some accomplishment of some sort. And later in life, the issue is integrity. How do I feel about what I've done as I face not being able to do any more? When you look back on the fact that you did your life as you did, and you review it, the text refers to Butler's notion of a life review, which we begin to do in our 50s or so. Look back and figure, well, I'm not going to set the world on fire the way I thought I was going to. I haven't done it yet. In fact, I can't. My kids are total failures. I screwed them up. And I can't have any more. So, it's too late to go back and start over. How do I feel about that? How do I make sense out of how I have lived my life as I face the end of it? So, Erickson constructed this set of eight stages that we go through: infancy, early childhood, later early childhood, middle childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, and on up through adulthood, as a way of helping us understand what are the issues that we're dealing with as our bodies change and our social situation changes and we have different expectations, different roles, different demands, as we're creating a self, a psyche. And if we're having problems in doing that, it'll show up in a stage specific or appropriate or compatible way. So if you work much with college students, one of the issues that's going to come up over and over again in the counseling center here or in private practice with college students, the issues are going to be framed as identity problems. I don't know who I am. I seem to be different every day. I hate my major. My parents don't know who I am. It's very important to have people know who you are so that you have a sense of identity. And they will demonstrate the problems that they're having in putting life together by expressing it in identity terms. In creating partner relationships, what happens is trying to create what Erickson described as intimacy. It's not quite the same as Sullivan's use of intimacy, because Sullivan is talking about a way of relating and a set of skills that we use in creating a connection with other people. What Erickson is describing as a sense of intimacy is the sense that our identity and another person's identity have something shared. That there's some part of me that not only can be intimate with another person, but that together we have created a joint identity as a couple, as partners, as a unit. Still separate people, but we have created something that is different. We've created the relationship, and that relationship becomes a part of us. When Erickson talked about the sense of intimacy, he said it's reflected in the language. When people are not creating a sense of intimacy but are working on identity issues, they talk about what I do. I'm going to the movies. I'm dating Susan. I'm going out with, I'm sleeping with, whatever. I'm doing this with so-and-so. That's an individual expression. It says, I'm doing this, and the other person that I might be doing it with is an add-on. The language is important. When people begin to form a committed relationship, something that has a history, and start to make the relationship part of their understanding of who they are, part of their identity, they change their language. So instead of saying, I'm going to a movie tonight, oh, and Sally's going with me, they say, we're going to the movie tonight. And everybody around them understands who we are. Obviously, they're not saying it together, and Sally may not even be there. But the fact that Fred has said, we, is assumed by everybody to mean them as a couple. So the language changes from the singular to the plural to reflect the fact that when you speak, you are speaking about yourself as part of a couple. And everybody understands that. Then you're creating a sense of intimacy. Now, you can be married and not have that. You can be with somebody for years and years and not have that sense. Sometimes people do that. They talk about my kids, not our kids. They talk about my house, not our house. And then they talk about my husband, or the guy. They're talking about themselves, and they're not creating a sense of intimacy in Erickson's sense, because they're still referring to the other person as somehow completely separate from them. They're not taking the other person into consideration when they think about themselves. Yes?
Is it possible
for the
process
of Yes. Yep. Exactly. In a couple of different ways, and that's what Erickson is really about, is where we get stuck, how we get stuck, and what odd non-normative experiences can do to us. For example, what happens in our culture for a 13-year-old who has a baby? It's not the way you're supposed to go through adolescence in our culture. She's working on identity. She's put herself in the situation that demands psychologically that she develop a sense of generativity about this baby, and she can't do that yet. In many cases, she can't do that. So she's caught because she's in a non-normative situation. If you look at children who experience in their social setting sexual behavior with adults, that's non-normative. Pathological, immoral, and wrong, and all of those things. But here's the kid trying to make sense out of the biology which says you're not ready for that, and a social setting which you understand is not the norm. So you leave a kid in a situation of trying to make sense of having been sexually abused within a family setting where that's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to feel safe. And your body isn't ready for it. And now you have to deal with that, and you don't have the equipment to deal with it. So what you see then are symptoms that emerge as the child tries to create an understanding of herself before she's able to do that, an understanding that incorporates activities that are not normative, not normal. So any kind of traumatic activity or very out-of-sequence experience can get a kid confused. Difficulty in any of the stages accumulates. So it's very difficult, for example, to create a sense of identity if along the way your parents have treated you in ways that make you feel ashamed all the time and incompetent. And then when you try to make decisions for yourself, you can't really do that because you haven't got a firm sense of autonomy, but you're making them anyway, and then you feel guilty. And then trying to be industrious on top of that leads you with an inflated or really deflated sense of your own abilities and a sense of inferiority. And then you take that into trying to create an identity, a sense of identity, and you're going to have the identity of loser, misfit. So the stages are, the stages reflect what Erickson described as an order, and they are in an expectable order because that's the biological foundation. And the social foundations ideally reflect that. If they're normal, they will. Different families will deal with different issues in different ways, but they will all deal with it. And when we see a kid who's having difficulty, we know we have a kid whose social setting is not dealing with the biological changes for the child in a helpful way, or a kid whose earlier experiences have led to an understanding of themselves in the world that is difficult to incorporate into a healthy resolution in the next stage or some later stage. So what you do in therapy, for those of you who are interested in psychological practice, what you do in therapy is whatever you've got, you interview to figure out, and you use an interview that's based on these concepts, the psychosocial issues, to figure out, to listen carefully how the person describes his or her problems, and then you do the history. You figure out where life got messed up for this person. How far back do you have to go to help the person untangle the sense that he or she has made out of life at that particular point? And often what you're dealing with is a stage-specific problem. And those are the easy ones. But sometimes we have a problem in a particular stage, as I said, because things have not gone well in previous stages. So then we have to go back and help the person make new sense, reframe, re-understand, create a new understanding of themselves and their history so they become aware of the impact that their experiences have had. Where was the cartoon? Newsweek. Yesterday. Great cartoon. Did you see it? The chicken is on the analyst's couch. And the chicken is saying, "Oh, that makes perfect sense. I crossed the road because my parents made me do it." Oh, I'm sorry. I can't resist that one. Why does the chicken cross the road? Because his parents made him do it. Okay, all right. Okay. That's what you get for asking, right, okay. The stages in Erickson's approach the stages are defined by the challenges that are inherent in the individual development and the corresponding set of expectations, demands, and risks and opportunities in the context. So they're defined by the combination of those. And there's a continuum of possibilities in each of the stages. And he describes it as a psychosocial issue. Take mistrust and trust are two ends of a continuum, especially if it's really deep, pathological, dark, paranoid mistrust. And Pollyanna, "I trust anybody, you know, the world is a great place," that's unrealistic too. They're both unrealistic. The challenge is for the infant to take the experience that she has and figure out what is the appropriate way to be given who I am biologically, think about temperament, and the experience that I've had. And in one setting, my parents have been really responsive. They've been the secure attachment kind of people. They've been loving. They never upset me. They take care of all of my needs. I may decide that the world is a pretty trustable and orderly place, and out of that I develop an abiding sense of trust. And I take that through life, that the world is an orderly place. That's how I approach it, because of what my parents did. In another culture, you may run into normal would be much less trusting. One of my favorite, if you've looked at some of the anthropological literature, there's a wonderful group, it's dying out for pretty good reason, called the Ik, whose approach to life is that there are evil spirits lurking around every corner and under every bush, and good parenting means that you teach your child to detect those spirits and ward them off. So part of good parenting is to make sure that you create a paranoid kid. And you do that by pinching the child, by taking its food out of its mouth and eating it yourself, and not meeting its needs, and letting it know through your daily handling that the world is a really tough and nasty place, and you'd better be prepared for it if you're going to survive. This is not a group of people who develop lasting bonds because they're so busy fighting the evil spirits in their world. And they blame each other a lot if something goes wrong because somebody didn't do the right ritual. Somebody has annoyed the spirits, and now we're all suffering because of that. So they like to pick people to blame, which is what paranoids do. If you mistrust everybody, then you pick somebody to blame and you kill them because they let the evil spirits get in there. It's a nice community. I wouldn't live there. What's going to happen in each stage is that the person is going to explore the range, try out various ways of approaching the world, and eventually settle on what is comfortable and have a sense of abiding trust, or develop a sense of autonomy because you're learning to do things for yourself and your parents are encouraging you to change your own clothes, go to the bathroom by yourself, tie your shoes, you know, be able to dial 911, whatever it is that you think a child ought to be able to do at 3 and 4. And if you can do those things that your parents expect of you, then you have the sense of autonomy. And there are many individual factors in how we resolve each of those issues. You know, temperament, gender, what our parents are doing for us, how much support they're giving us. And as you develop then whatever the sense is that you're going to take out of a particular stage, you carry that sense into the next stage, and then you start tackling the next set of issues, which are raised by the biology and the demands of your community. And if you're in luck, the biology and the social settings that you're in will be in pretty good sync. But sometimes they're not. For example, we talked in the biological and the cognitive development domains about having your biological development way ahead of your cognitive development so that you look old but don't think old, think mature, and then you have a family that's dealing with whatever they think you are. And how people respond to you is going to be based primarily on the biological development. So if you're a very early mature, the demands may be way over your head. On the other hand, if you're an early cognitive mature, people's expectations may not reflect and respect your intellectual ability. So they treat you like a little kid because that's what you look like. Those experiences contribute to how you create your sense of identity. Normal and healthy are defined in Erickson's theory by what is adaptive in the context, given your personality. So, what is healthy for one person may not be healthy for the other person. It's a very individual path that we carve through these eight stages. What gives us a sense of competence contributes to what is healthy for us. What keeps our anxiety low? I'm going to adapt in ways that help me feel that I fit in and am competent in the social settings that I'm faced with and keep my anxiety low. And I may develop all kinds of odd behaviors as a way of keeping my anxiety low and fitting into the environment if it's an odd environment. And then finally, what's healthy is what helps us prepare for the next stages. Okay. So we're going to go through these series of stages driven by the biology and by the social expectations. Whether we're ready for the next one or not, we're going to go into it because the society and our biological circumstances, our internal changes, are going to push us into that next stage. It's also important in Erickson that there are some common misunderstandings, and these are not represented in this text. It's an improvement. They corrected some problems in it. And one of those is that you have to complete each stage successfully before moving on to the next stage. That's not Erickson. Erickson's point is, you will get driven into the next stage regardless of whether you're ready for it or not. And if you're not ready, then you're going to mess up in the next stage. It's going to be difficult for you. It's going to create a lot of anxiety because you're going to be given expectations and demands that you can't meet. And that's going to make you weird. It's going to give you problems. It's going to make you anxious. So you don't have to complete them. Ideally, you will. You don't actually complete the stages. You just reach a resolution for them. Each stage continues on. You never quit constructing an identity. It's just that during adolescence, identity is most important because that's when it first ascends. It rises to the top in Erickson's view. But then you spend the rest of your life reconstructing your identity to take into account all of the experiences and relationships that you continue to have, and we'll talk about that on Monday as we talk about the process of adulthood. And another misunderstanding is that if one stage is resolved negatively, you're doomed. You know, life is going to be hell. Erickson was a therapist, so obviously he didn't believe that. You're not doomed. You are if you don't go into therapy, or you're going to muck up your life. But even good experiences, good transactions, and a lot of self-work can help you develop a more normal way of being if you've been mucked up by your experiences early on. So the process of therapy is designed to help you understand and then construct for yourself new understanding and new ways of being that will let you get back into a healthy stance in regard to both your own development and the social context that you're in. Okay. Did any of that make sense? Let's see. Talia doesn't have enough to read. So if you'll just take one of those and pass them back.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's just one question.
Yes, you can keep your notes open. And when you're done, just put it on the table in the front. Raise your hand if you still need one. Pass the extras back, please. Where are the extras?